From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
There's no doubt that one of the major issues of 20th century history, surely in the United States, is corporate propaganda.
Professor Noam Chomsky on propaganda and mind control. Then the French Prime Minister quits after a left victory in the first round of parliamentary elections, and prosecutors drop charges in the notorious North Carolina Little Rascals daycare sex abuse case. We'll look at the destroyed lives of the accused.
I always thought that when you didn't do that, if you're accused of something you didn't do, the system will take care of you. You don't have to be afraid. You didn't do it. You found out the fact that you didn't do it is not relevant at all in the justice system. Not at all. Whether you, innocence is just not, doesn't come into it. You have, that I found very scary, that the system will not take care of you.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Congolese opposition militants said they will defy President Laurent Kabila's ban on politics with a march in the capital on Wednesday, and will follow this up with sit-ins and stay-home protests next week. But elsewhere in the city of 5 million people today, there was little immediate response to the ban, with shops, offices, and markets open and traffic circulating normally. Meanwhile, the New York Times says reports point to a mass killing of refugees in the Congo. An article on the front page says since the middle of last month, no outsider has been allowed down the 6 miles of jungle road that begin at a roadblock manned by soldiers at kilometer 42 south of Kisangani. But a growing number of accounts emerging from that zone suggests that some form of systematic killing of refugees and disposal of the evidence has been taking place there. It goes on to say the accounts suggest, although they don't conclusively prove, that people have died in significant numbers in the jungle, and that their remains, often in the form of ashes, are being disposed of en masse. Aid workers now express a deepening conviction that the jungle astride the road, as it runs along a bend in the Congo River, has been turned into a killing camp. And this news from Burma. Its main opposition party, led by democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, today has appealed to the ruling military junta to stop suppressing the movement and hold dialogue with it. And you're listening to Democracy Now! In other international news, the political reverberations from this weekend's election in France are still being felt. Yesterday, Prime Minister Alain Juppé announced he would resign after his right-wing coalition government suffered major losses in the first round of legislative elections. The socialists and the communists were the big winners in Sunday's balloting as French voters cast their ballots against the conservatives' unpopular austerity measures that targeted social programs and employment benefits. The extreme right National Front also did well, winning 15% of the vote Sunday, and now the racist National Front is positioned to be the arbiter in many of the remaining races. Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of the National Front, told French radio he will announce on Thursday night how sympathizers should vote Sunday in the second and final round of balloting. Daniel Singer joins us now from Paris to talk about this week's French elections. He's the European correspondent for The Nation magazine. First, your reaction to Alain Juppé's announcement that he will resign after Sunday's second round of parliamentary elections.
He has given a sort of advanced resignation. He said, I'm going to run this campaign till next Sunday, and after that, I'm going to resign. Now, this obviously is the reaction of President Chirac, who sees that the odds are for the moment that the left is going to win and that he'll have to live to cohabit, as it is said in France, with a socialist prime minister. Trying to avoid that, he's doing everything, and the last thing was to dismiss the prime minister. This may really be taken by the French people as an act of panic. He hopes that it will be taken as a sign, I've accepted your message and I'm changing. But actually, why does he change now and why didn't he change earlier, you see? Secondly, what alternative policy is going to give? It's not just a question of man. of the man, the prime minister in France, when you, the president and the prime minister are of the same political complexion, the prime minister really acts as a screen. That is to say, you can have the good Tsar and the bad prime minister. That wasn't working any longer because it was so obvious that Juppé, the prime minister, was really the servant of the president. You see, it was the president who was responsible for that policy. Is he changing the policy? What kind of a policy? What he can't tell the French people is, I want to squeeze you because I want to introduce a policy that benefits profits and doesn't benefit the ordinary people. That's the policy that I have been following for the last 2 years, and my predecessor, the other right-wing predecessor, did it for the previous 2 years, you see. Now, that was the policy of Chirac, and the prime minister was only his executor. So that's the difficulty. What he's going to say, it's quite obvious. He's going to say, you voted for change, and I'm going to give you change. But will he say who's going to be the next prime minister? What kind of a policy? What difference it's going to make? That's his difficulty. This is a gimmick. Will it work? Nobody, you see, it's a very, very tight result for the moment. I mean, the odds are, if you ask me now to bet, I would say that I'm putting my money on the socialist, on the left winning this election, the united left winning this election. But I wouldn't risk too much money on it.
Daniel Singer, what's your reaction to Sunday's vote?
I suppose it was a surprise for the general public, not for everybody. I actually must say that I expected it to happen because the way in which the president announced the thing, it was quite obvious when he dissolved, when he made the snap election, it was quite obvious that when you have a very big majority in the assembly and you have this possibility of having staging an election, you do it only because you're assuming that in a year's time, when you're compelled to have an election, it will be worse for you than at the moment. In other words, that because of the measures that are supposed to be taken in connection with the Maastricht Treaty and with the so-called convergence tests, that you will have, you will ask people to tighten their belts. So before you do it, you have the snap election. The French people are not fools. And so I was not very surprised by the fact that it turned out that it was a gamble that didn't come off.
I've been looking at Reuters and the reaction around the world. It's interesting to note Russia's NTV commercial TV commented on France's far-right gains, saying the matter is not as much in the defeat of the ruling coalition of President Chirac, which has lost to the left, as in the large number of votes for the National Front ultra-right party, saying this is the largest victory of a pro-fascist party since World War II.
That I don't know whether it's the largest, because let's say that the Monsieur Le Pen already did the same score in the presidential election. But let us look at various things. There are three things that one can say. One is, and what is, I think that's the main one, is that the gamble of Chirac didn't come off. That is to say that in his attempt to introduce a tougher economic policy, he wanted to have a free hand, a blank check, and he didn't get it. Whatever happens on the second ballot, it's quite clear that he was disavowed by the French people. So that's one thing. The second, which is less striking still for the moment, is the recovery by the French left, which is showing signs at least of appearing as a possible credible alternative. So that's the second. And the third point is, quite rightly, I think, the fact that the poison is still spreading through the French body politic, and that the National Front has improved on its previous best score in the parliamentary election. It was 12.5, let's say, last time, 4 years ago. It is now 15%. And that is something which is quite dangerous. But we have to understand why it happens. And I think that the main thing, if we have to explain that, we have to say that this is the result of two things, of the economic crisis on one side and of the fact that the left has not been able to answer that economic crisis, to provide progressive radical solution, and if it doesn't provide that, then you're going to have reactionary ones, and that is what is happening. In other words, as long as you have a consensus politics and not a real alternative on the left, you will have a continued rise of the National Front, and I think that is something that is potentially quite dangerous.
Yet France is well ahead of the United States in terms of organizing when you look at the massive labor protests last year.
No, that's if you're quite right to say that the massive labor protests last year were something that changed the political and the ideological climate in France. And even what happens now is to a large extent the effect of that, because it has pushed the socialists to the left to some extent. It has frightened Chirac, who therefore tried to get this blank check and so on. But I would say that for the moment, you don't have yet a real political representation, a political expression of that great social movement. That social movement, I think, was a historical, if historians look at it, was, at least in ideological terms, a turning point, because for the first time it really said, it really was not impressed by the argument that is being used to say there is no alternative, there can be no alternative, you have to accept it, whether it's good or bad, you have to accept it. You had millions of people in France standing up and saying, to hell with your future if that is the future that you're offering us and our children. That was extremely important, and I think that one cannot understand French politics now without taking that into account. But between that, between a, let's say, a great refusal and the alternative, time is needed. Time is needed to elaborate a program, a project, a vision, and so on. And I don't have the impression that the French socialists, who are the main party, or even parties to the left of the French Socialist Party, have for the moment given that alternative.
Well, Daniel Singer, I want to thank you very much for joining us, the Nation magazine's European correspondent, speaking to us from Paris. And you are listening to Democracy Now!, where we switch gears now. Most people associate the term propaganda with totalitarian dictatorships. Yet propaganda is an important element in democratic societies. The control and use of images and information can alter perceptions, frame debate, influence opinion, and most importantly, change behavior. Noam Chomsky, MIT professor and noted linguist, has long studied and documented contemporary uses of propaganda. The author of dozens of works, including Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky is widely recognized as one of the major intellectual figures of this era. Today we bring you a special seminar given by Professor Chomsky on propaganda and public mind control to trade union leaders from the United States, Canada, Australia, and Japan. It was recorded by Alternative Radio.
There's no doubt that one of the major issues of 20th century history, surely in the United States, is corporate propaganda. That's a huge industry. In fact, it extends over the, obviously, the commercial media, but the whole range of systems that reach the public, the entertainment industry, television, a good bit of what appears in the schools, a lot of what appears straight out in the newspapers and so on. Huge amount of that comes straight out of the public relations industry, which was established in this country early in the century and then sort of developed mainly in the 20s and on, and has become an enormous industry. It's now spreading over the rest of the world, but it's primarily here. And its goal from the beginning, perfectly openly and consciously, was to control the public mind, as they put it. And the reason was that the public mind was seen as the greatest threat to corporations. That's from early in the century. Business power was strong, but it's a very free country by comparative standards, and it's hard to call on state violence, not impossible, but hard to call upon state violence to crush people's efforts to achieve freedom and rights and justice. So therefore, it was recognized early on that it's going to be necessary to control people's minds. I should say that's not a new insight either. You know, you can read it in David Hume and the Enlightenment, where it was already recognized. In fact, you go back to the earliest stirrings of democratic revolutions in England in the 17th century, and there already was concern that we're not going to be able to control people by force, and we therefore have to control them by other means, controlling what they think, what they feel, their attitudes toward one another. I mean, all sorts of mechanisms of control are going to have to be devised, which will replace the efficient use of force and violence that was available to a much greater extent earlier on, and as has been fortunately declining, you know, not uniformly, but often declining through the years, particularly here, leading to the need for other methods of control. You don't have to move very far from the Cambridge elite to learn about it. The major, the leading figure of the public relations industry is a highly regarded Cambridge liberal, you know, Roosevelt Kennedy liberal, died recently, Edward Bernays, who wrote the standard manual of the public relations industry back in the 1920s, which is very much worth reading. Remember, I'm not talking about the right wing here. This is way at the left liberal end of American politics. His book, it's called On Propaganda, or maybe just Propaganda. I should mention that terminology changed during the Second World War. Prior to the Second World War, the term propaganda was used quite openly and freely for controlling the public mind. It got bad connotations during the Second World War because of, you know, Hitler and that sort of thing. So the term was dropped, and now there's other terms used. But if you read the literature in the social sciences and the public relations industry and so on back in the, say, 20s and the 30s, they describe what they're doing as propaganda. This manual is for the rising public relations industry, and he opens by pointing out that the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is the central is the essential feature of a democratic society. It's the essence of democracy, as he later pointed out. And he said, we have the means to carry this out now. He said, we have the means to regiment people's minds as efficiently as armies regiment their bodies. And we must do this. First of all, it's the essential feature of democracy, but also, sort of footnote, it's the way to maintain power structures and authority structures and wealth and so on, roughly the way it is. It's worth remembering something else that they usually don't teach you very much about in school, and that is, if you go back to the origins of American society, it was founded on the principle that was stated very explicitly by the leading framer, James Madison, at the Constitutional Conventions, as he put it, the primary responsibility of government is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. And Madison recognized, he's a smart guy, that this was going to be a serious problem if a democratic system were established. It was going to, if people had the right to vote, he used England as his model. England was the model for democracy in those days, right? It's like, I'm talking about 1780s. And he pointed out in the debates on the Constitutional Convention something which everybody ought to read in third grade in a free society. I mean, this is the origins of our society, you know. He pointed out that in England, if they had the right to vote, which fortunately they didn't, he said pretty soon you would find people calling for redistribution of property and for a tax on property rights for what nowadays we'd call agrarian reform. It was mostly an agricultural society. He didn't use the term agrarian reform, but same thing. He said, people will start calling for agrarian reform. Obviously, that's intolerable. And we have to protect our own society against that kind of injustice by ensuring that the rights of property prevail. He recognized that, he said, it's a problem now. He was already concerned in the 1780s by what he called symptoms of a leveling spirit. That is, people are trying to, you know, feel that property ought to be more equitably distributed. That's a danger. But he said that the danger is going to become much more severe over time as more and more people are marginalized and dispossessed and secretly yearn for a more equal distribution of life's blessings. Now, if those people get the vote, we're going to be in trouble, because it's going to be hard to protect the minority, the opulent, against the majority, which is what government's all about. And he therefore designed the constitutional system, which was intended to prevent that danger. The way he set it up, he and the other framers, because it was virtually unanimous, and there was virtually no disagreement about this, the one person.
You're listening to Professor Noam Chomsky of the Massachusetts Institute of Linguistics, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is a world-renowned linguist and political analyst. We'll be back with him in just 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with a seminar given recently by Professor Noam Chomsky to trade union activists from the United States, Canada, Australia, and Japan.
Now, by the late 30s, there was a big anti-labor campaign that had built up. It's with new techniques, you know. There was still use of force, but it was understood that that's not going to work the way it did. So there was a shift to more propaganda. Community organizing. The main idea, it's called the Mohawk Valley Formula, I guess, is that what it was called? Something like that. Yeah, Mohawk Valley Formula was designed by a lot of public relations hotshots around 36, 37, at the time of some of the steel strikes, to have a new, what they called scientific methods of strike breaking. We don't just come in, you know, with clubs and shoot people and smash their heads and that sort of thing. We do it the scientific way because the old way doesn't work anymore. And the scientific methods of strike breaking were, in fact, drawn from the public relations ideas of the kind that I talked about. The main idea was to mobilize the community against the strikers and the union activists, to present a picture which is by now so standard that you can hardly turn on the tube without seeing it, because it's just poured out in, you know, like streams ever since then. But the basic idea is to present a picture of the world that looks kind of like this. There's us, you know, kind of like big happy family in the community. The honest workman going off every morning with his lunchbox, his loyal wife who's making the meals and taking care of the kids, the hardworking executive who's toiling day and night in the interests of his workers in the community, the friendly banker who's running around looking for people to lend money to, and so on and so forth. That's us, you know, and we're all in harmony. Harmony was a big word. We're in harmony. We're all together. It's Americanism. You might take a look at that word Americanism. It's an unusual term. It's the kind of term that you only find in totalitarian societies, as far as I know. So like in the Soviet Union, anti-Sovietism was considered the gravest of all crimes, you know. And the Brazilian generals had some concept like that, anti-Brazilian. But try, say, publishing a book on anti-Italianism and see what happens in the streets of Rome or Milan. I mean, people won't even bother laughing. It's a ludicrous idea. The idea of Italianism or Norwayism or something like that, or these would just be objects of ridicule in societies that have some kind of residue of a democratic culture inside people's heads. I don't mean in the formal systems. But in totalitarian societies, it is used, and as far as I know, the United States is the only free society that has such a concept. Maybe there's another one. You might try it in places you know. But anyhow, Americanism is an anti-Americanism and un-Americanism and so on. These are concepts which go along with harmony and getting rid of those outsiders and all that kind of stuff. Another part is simply to induce hatred and fear among people. So it's a diverse society. You know, you go to Europe, most places are pretty uniform. This is a very diverse society. So it's easy for propagandists. It's pretty easy to get people to, you know, hate the guy next door because it looks a little different or one thing or another. And huge campaigns go on to instigate divisions among people. I don't have to tell you about this. It's all so familiar. You go on. But these are very natural techniques of social control. If you can't control people by force, you have to control their minds, you have to control their attitudes, you have to, exactly like they say. Well, going back to the Mohawk Valley formula, the idea was to move into a community, flood it with where there's a strike going on, flood it with propaganda, you know, take over the media, the churches, the schools, everywhere else, pour in this propaganda about harmony and so on, the way I described it. And then there's those bad guys out there who are trying to disrupt our harmonious lives, you know, like that union organizer is probably a communist or an anarchist anyway, and probably un-American, and he's trying to, you know, destroy all these wonderful things we have, and we got to band together and kick him out. You know, we have to defend our way of life against this. A lot of religion gets thrown in. Remember that the United States is an extremely fundamentalist country. I mean, you look comparative statistics. It usually, religious fundamentalism declines as industrialization goes up. It's pretty close correlation. The United States is off the chart. You know, it ranks with devastated peasant societies, probably more fundamentalist than Iran. Why this is so, is, I don't know. But, I mean, in fact, it's a complicated question. But one factor is that it was certainly consciously fomented by business leaders. That goes way back to the 19th century, when they were supporting their favorite, John D. Rockefeller's favorite evangelist was, who we poured a lot of money into, was some guy who said that people ought to have more enlightened ideas than labor agitation. That was one of his famous phrases. And the more enlightened ideas are, you know, go to church and listen to orders and, you know, do what they tell you and shut up. You know, that's the more enlightened idea. Well, take right now, let's say, as an example. There's a couple days ago, I don't know if you're bothered, I put myself through the pain of reading the New York Times every day for some masochistic reason, which I won't try to explain. But they've got a, you know, their big chief correspondent, sort of the main thinker, is a guy named Thomas Friedman, who had an article 3 or 4 days ago in which he, big think piece, in which he said, well, he said the Cold War's over, so, you know, the breakdown isn't hawks and doves anymore. We have to have some new breakdown. And he said the new breakdown, he says there's two. One is between integrationists and, what was the other term, I forget, you know, anti-integrationists. That means people who are in favor of more globalization and what they call free trade, which isn't free trade, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And people who want to slow it down or end it. That's one break. And the other is between people who are in favor of a safety net and those who think that everybody ought to, you know, be on your own and get what you can. Okay, so those are the two ways people break up. And that gives you four possible types of people, right? Two of them he sort of dismisses as lunatics. So there's the Zapatistas and Ross Perot. They fit into two of those boxes. The other two boxes are sort of sane people, Clinton and Gingrich. And I'll put aside Clinton, but Gingrich, and this gets right to your point, I think. Gingrich is put in the corner that says integrationist and devil take the hindmost, you know, everybody for themselves. Well, that's testable. You know, it's testable that that's Gingrich's position. For example, on the question of whether Gingrich is an integrationist, like in favor of free trade, we can ask how he reacted when the Reagan administration instituted the greatest wave of protectionism since the 1930s. That's just straight protectionism. alongside a huge increase in public subsidies to private power, to industry, along with, say, the biggest nationalization in American history, the takeover of Continental Illinois Bank, and so on and so forth. That's all radically anti-integrationist. Okay, how did Newt Gingrich react? We can ask that question. Answer is he thought it's great. You know, what about the safety net story? I mean, Gingrich is in favor of people sort of being out there on their own, you know, rugged entrepreneurs and so on. I mean, you can check that too. He represents a county district, Cobb County, Georgia, which happens to be the, and he happens to hold the national championship in bringing federal subsidies to his rich constituents, to be precise, among suburban counties in the United States. Cobb County ranks third in federal subsidies, ranks right after Arlington, Virginia, which is part of the federal government. So, of course, they get a lot of federal subsidies, like the Pentagon's there and so on. And Brevard County, Florida, which is the home of the Space Center. So it's another part of the federal government. But if you move outside the federal government itself, Gingrich's district is number one. You know, they get more federal subsidies than anybody. The biggest employer in Cobb County is Lockheed, which is a publicly subsidized private profit corporation. I mean, they don't, you know. I mean, they sell commercial planes, but those are just, as everyone knows, they're just, you know, kind of, they use military technology is, the way the system is designed, technology is developed under the guise of the military and then handed over to private power when it works. Oh, that's true of everything. Airplanes, computers, the internet, you name it. And Cobb County is right at the center of this. Well, he's in favor of being, you know, all out on your own and fighting in this harsh world. Ridiculous. He's the biggest welfare freak in the country. That's literally true, except that he wants the welfare to go to very rich people. Notice this is not what's called corporate welfare. The corporate welfare, what they call corporate welfare, which also never gets touched, is some different category completely. That's like giving a special, you know, shot in the arm to some particular corporation. This is something quite different. This is the way in which our economy works. The way our economy works, take any just about any dynamic sector of it, you know, at least that I know and I've studied, and you find that it's based on massive public subsidy and privatization of profit. Public pays the costs and takes the risks, and private systems make the profit, if there is any. Cobb County is just an extreme example of this. All right, now you ask, how come people are deluded? Well, how often do you read this? You know, I mean, like, these aren't particularly subtle facts. I mean, these are like glaringly obvious facts. But, okay, because the reason is because people like Thomas Friedman and everyone else in the business knows you're not supposed to write about these things. I mean, I don't know, I'm not claiming he thinks about it, you know. In fact, the people who write about it are probably more deeply propagandized even than the people they're talking to. You know, you cannot be a good propagandist unless it's in your bones. I mean, it's extremely hard to lie. I think we all know that from personal experience. You know, it's hard to lie to people. Every one of us lies to people all the time, unless we're some kind of crazy angel. But the way we do it, if you, I mean, I'm sure you know this, is you first convince yourself that what you're saying is true. You know, like you're an 8-year-old kid and you steal a toy from your brother, you know, and your mother comes in and yells at you. You don't say, well, you know, I wanted the toy and he had it, so, you know, I took it because I'm stronger than him. What you say is, it really wasn't his, and besides, he'd taken a toy of mine, and anyway, I needed it more than he did, so it was right for me to take it, okay? You know, I mean, if people haven't had that experience, there are some other species, I think. But that kind of experience goes all the way up to being a hotshot journalist for the New York Times. You know, you don't even make it into those circles unless you're already so deeply overwhelmed by doctrine and propaganda that you can't even think in other terms. And so you'll read, say, you know, liberal columnists in the New York Times very angrily saying when people talk like this, nobody tells me what to write. I write anything I feel like, which is absolutely true. And if they didn't, if you know, people with real power weren't sure that they were going to say the right things, they wouldn't be in a position to write anything they feel like. Well, how does that work? You know, it starts from childhood. It starts in kindergarten on television. There's selection for obedience from the very first moment. I mean, you just think about, I mean, I'm guessing, maybe I'm wrong, so you tell me if I'm wrong, but at least when I think about my own school experience or any other school experience I know about, there was selection for obedience. I mean, I ended up going to fancy colleges like this place. And the way I did it was, I know exactly how I did it, by shutting up, you know. Like if I thought that the high school teacher was a horse's ass, which I did most of the time, I didn't say, hey, what you're saying, actually sometimes I did and got thrown out of class, but I learned not to say anything, just say, okay, you know, I'll do the next stupid assignment, and because I know that that's the way I get ahead and ultimately I'll do this and that. You know, if you have, you know, whatever ability it takes to do this kind of thing and you are sufficiently disciplined and passive, you sort of make it through up to the higher echelons. There are people who don't. I mean, I know some, like some of my own kids just didn't. And they get into trouble. They're called behavior problems or, you know, disruptive, or you stick drugs in them or something or other, because they're just too independent, you know. And people who are independent are a pain in the neck. You know, they disrupt the system. And they're going to be cut off one way or another. I can tell you just, you know, in graduate school, I'm teaching mostly graduate school, and you read applications, you can detect between the lines when the person who's writing a recommendation is telling you, keep away from this person, they're going to cause you trouble, which means usually they're going to go off and do their own thing or something like that. I don't want to exaggerate. In the sciences, it's somewhat different. And the reason is the sciences simply require this kind of independence. They'll die, you know, unless people are challenging all the time and questioning. So when you look at people who are, say, studying physics at MIT or something, yeah, it's totally different. Because you just encourage people to be challenging and creative and so on and so forth. But in most areas, you don't. You want them to be passive and obedient and supportive and to fit their, you know, to fit some kind of niche inside a managerial system. Which is top-down and doesn't make too much of a fuss and so on. And the people who don't accept this, they're weeded out in one or another fashion. So, it's a tricky question. I don't mean to suggest there's an easy answer to your question, or if there is, I don't know it. But it seems to me that an awful lot of our whole system of kind of thought control, by that I mean education, you know, television, family life, all sorts of things, is sort of geared to supporting that kind of passivity. And institutions that break out of it, as the labor movement does, they are subject to a lot of, they're crushed insofar as one can crush them. I mean, the labor movement always broke out of this. Its picture was always different from the very beginning. You go back to the beginnings of the labor movement, it's, you know, farmers bitterly opposing the degrading and oppressive modes of industrial capitalist organization that were being forced on them. Actually, one of the most interesting books I know, if you haven't read it, I'd urge you to, is the first modern book on labor history that I know of by a guy named Norman Ware, around 1924. It was just reprinted, so it's easy to get, but it's about the labor movement in eastern Massachusetts around 1850 and 60. It's mostly quotes from the labor press, which are just fascinating. It's mostly young women from the farms, what they called factory girls, like 18-year-old kid comes in from the farms and she's working in the mills in Lowell, or artisans in Boston, you know, and people like that. They had their own press. They had a very lively, extensive press, big, in fact. You know, it's like the scale of the commercial press in those days. And it's very interesting. I mean, it's very eloquent, it's very well written. They took for granted, as the labor movement always has, unless it's beaten out of people's heads, that those who work in the mills ought to own them. They regarded industrial capitalism as just another form of slavery. This is without, you know, no Marx, no socialism, you know, no foreign radicals, none of that stuff. It's all just working people from their own experience. You know. very literate, incidentally. Like, they, one of the things they complained about was that their culture was being taken away from them. Like, an artisan in Boston, if he had a little extra money, would hire a boy to read to him, and that meant read classics, you know. They said, look, the values that we fought for in the American Revolution, they're being taken away from us. We're being forced into another kind of tyranny, which we don't want, namely the tyranny of the hierarchic industrial system. And they also opposed the, what they called the new spirit of the age. This is like 1850. The new spirit of the age is gain wealth, forgetting all but self. Okay, ever hear that one? A little fancier, but the same thing that is drilled into everyone's head every day, today. You know, you got to gain wealth, forgetting about everybody else. Well, they were trying to drill it into people's heads in 1850, and they were resisting it because it's degrading. You know, it's not the way human beings are. It takes a long time to drive normal human sentiments out of people's heads, and they keep popping up again. And in fact, I think, at least looks to me, the whole history of the labor movement is a struggle against the new spirit of the age. Well, that's one of the reasons it's constantly repressed. And other independent efforts are also constantly repressed, not always successfully. Like, the world's a lot better than it was 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, for that matter, because these struggles tend to, you know, they get repressed, but they leave a residue.
Professor Noam Chomsky, giving a seminar on propaganda and public mind control to a group of trade union leaders from the United States, Canada, Australia, and Japan. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, prosecutors dropped all pending charges against the two remaining defendants in the notorious Little Rascals case in North Carolina, 8 years after sex abuse allegations were filed on behalf of more than two dozen preschoolers. Prosecutors said they're dropping the 99 pending charges against Little Rascals daycare owner Bob Kelly Jr. and seven charges against Catherine Dawn Wilson, who was the center's cook. Well, today we just happen to be joined by Ofra Bekele. She is a frontline producer who has done three documentaries on the Little Rascals daycare sexual abuse case. Her first, in 1991, was called Innocence Lost. In 93, she did a documentary called Innocence Lost, The Verdict. And now tonight, on Frontline, airing at 9 o'clock around the country on PBS, Innocence Lost, The Plea. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, why don't you tell us what this case is all about?
Well, the case is one of those very complicated cases. It's a case that started in 1989 with allegations, with rumors of sexual abuse of children in a little town, Edenton, North Carolina, a very beautiful little town, very prestigious daycare, who was run by one of the most known people in the town. And a police investigation began, and there were rumors, there were phones, there were questions, and before you know it...
It was kids who told their parents, and then the parents...
No, it was not kids who told their parents. It was one mother whose son was slapped, and she was very unhappy, and she was a very good friend of the owner. She wanted an apology. She felt she didn't get the apology. She began to talk to other mothers. There was another mother who wasn't very, whose children was at that point 3.5 years old. They were really very, very young children. The other mother, her child didn't like the daycare. She was a friend of the police officer. She then talked to the police officer, who have just happened to come from a seminar on sexual abuse of children. And the police officer said, oh, well, maybe you should ask him questions. Well, with one thing and another, the child was saying, well, we play doctor. Who plays doctor? Mr. Bob, who was the owner of the daycare, plays doctor. Eventually, they asked him, who else does he play doctor with? So the three and a half year old named names. They went to the other kids and they said, we were told that Mr. Bob played doctor. Before you knew it, there were three children involved. And it was such a small town. It's a 5,000 people town. And within months, there were 90 children involved. All the children were sent to therapists, and everybody disclosed abuse. Everybody. In other words, if within 2 months, between September and December 1989.
When you say they went to therapists, is this those kind of, quote, therapist investigators who are trained to elicit this kind of response kids?
I would say yes. I mean, they would not describe themselves like that. But therapists, I mean, each therapist had like 15 children, so there was tremendous cross contamination of the same daycare. They talked to the police all the time. They reported to the police. They reported to the parents what other children said. The parents asked the children. So there was once. I mean, there were incredible examples of one mother meeting another mother and saying, "Did your son say anything about a boat?" And the mother said, no, but I'll go check. And she went home to check. And within a week, every child has had a boat story. One was on a fishing boat, and one was on a yacht, and one was on a rowboat. And they were all thrown into the water where there were sharks. And they were all abused on boats. And that was, you know. So there was tremendous cross-contamination.
Were parents allowed to come into the daycare center any time of the day?
Any time of the day.
Did parents come in?
Yes, any time. They had babies there. There was a room where they left their 5 and 6 months old, you know, and kids, babies. So they could come any time, and they did come any time. They would come to take the kid to a doctor or have lunch with the kid or whatever.
So talk about what happened. The allegations were brought in 1989.
Yeah.
When was the trial and who was tried?
By the winter of 1990, they arrested seven people. Five people worked in the daycare. It was Bob Kelly and his wife Betsy Kelly. There was a young woman by the name of Robin Byram. She was 18 then, and she had a baby of 9 months old. It was her first job out of high school. She worked there for a few months. There was another woman named Dawn Wilson, who was a single mother of a five-year-old. And then the main reason she took the job was three-year-old, I'm sorry, was that her child could be with her in the daycare. And then there were two people that had nothing to do with the daycare. The daycare was called Little Rascals. Two people who just had nothing to do with that. And they were in jail for... Two people got out on bail, and the rest were in jail for between 1 and 3.5 years, awaiting trial, on under a bond of over $1 million. And finally, you know, after a year, they reduced the bond of the younger women. Betsy Kelly stayed in jail, and in 1992.
What happened to their own kids, the 9-month-old and the 5-year-old?
The 9-month-old, the husband just took care of the child. Betsy and Bob, child of six, went to live with her sister. Betsy was married to Bob. Dawn was a single mother, so her mother took care of her child. And they were in jail, and they were and all through this time, they were offered, say anything, talk to us, we'll let you out. And the girls were saying, but there's nothing to... They told everything they knew. They said, there's nothing to tell. I mean, what the prosecution accused them of is conspiracy. In other words, saying they were all involved.
And how did they say they were sexually abused, these kids?
Oh, How did it? In many ways. I mean, they were sexually abused. They said that they shoved knives and scissors and hammer toes into their, you know, vaginas and anal openings. They said that they forced the children to have sex, that they had sex with the children. I mean, you name it. There were also very fantastic allegations. I mean, that they killed babies, that they were abused out of in spaceships, that Bob came and abused them at their home.
Now, the ones that they said actually did it, as opposed to conspiracy, were Bob, who was the owner.
Everybody did it.
Oh, they said that everybody
did,
including
it.
Don.
Everybody. Uh-huh. Don was eventually sentenced to life. Don was offered a plea bargain. And she was asked to just say she was guilty on few things. She said she couldn't. She said, how could you say she was guilty of something she didn't do? And she was offered to spend a few months in jail and walk.
We're talking to Frontline producer Ofra Bekel, who has won a number of awards for two documentaries she did on Edenton, North Carolina's Little Rascals Daycare sexual abuse case. And now she's produced another one, which will be airing tonight. It's the final in the three, I think, called Innocence Lost, The Plea. And news has come out in the last few days about the case, although it has been going on for some 8 years. Prosecutors have dropped all pending charges against the two remaining defendants in the case. These are those that decided not to take plea bargains and went to jail. Now, Bob Kelly, who ran Little Rascals Daycare Center, his wife, Betsy Kelly, after seeing that he got life, she plea bargained to her family's horror.
Yeah, she was offered a plea bargain, and she struggled, and she really struggled. And she took it, finally. And they offered her a very interesting plea. They offered her a plea that is called no contest. In other words, she could say, I did not do it, I'm innocent.
Spiro Agnew is no longer
contender. Spiro Agnew, not contender, exactly. But in the eyes of the law, she's considered guilty. And that's a very rare plea to give to someone who's a child molester. You know, I mean, you don't give those pleas to somebody who's that kind of a criminal. But they wanted that plea very badly. And and that was the only thing that she would agree to say, no contest, I am not guilty, I'm just tired and I'm afraid. And so she took the plea, she had to serve another 10 months in jail, and she was out. And now, of course, she had to watch the cases dismissed. She has a record in which it's said that she is a felon and she has to live with it for the rest of her life.
But her husband, Bob Kelly, is not totally off the hook.
No, her husband, Bob Kelly, is not totally off the hook. What has happened, and this is really totally outrageous, what happened was that once the case was overturned in about a year and a half ago, and once they realized that, because of the documentaries, there was a tremendous UN cry. I mean, there were a lot of letters being written. There was tremendous public pressure. What are you doing? And so what they have done is something really fiendish. They came up with eight charges of sexual abuse that Kelly was supposed to have sexual abuse another child 10 years ago.
Not at Little Rascals.
Before Little Rascal. And they said they just found out about it, and they are going to prosecute him on that. If he's convicted, he gets the same life in prison. What is very interesting is that at the time that child said that she was molested by Bob, every child in Edenton said they were molested by Kelly. I mean, this was the thing. Also, we know that the prosecution knew about it for years and didn't do anything about it. They didn't even send the child to therapy, which they are bound by law to do. Why now suddenly did they remember it and are prosecuting it, which is a good question.
But doesn't that suggest something real if this kid from another place, who is now presumably she's a grown-up, that she says she remembers this?
But she said it in 1992. It's not something new that she told them. And she didn't come now and told them. She told it to them during the trial.
But even still, you're very much convinced of their innocence. The fact that she was at another place and felt this had happened to her, does that in any way suggest to you that possibly it happened?
Not really, because if they thought it happened, why didn't they do something about it in 1992? I mean, they knew of the case.
Was it just too much?
But it's not too much. They are bound by law at least to send her to therapy. Why didn't they give her any help? Mm. Why didn't they send her to a therapy? If they thought that this could have happened, why didn't they give her some help? The state paid for all the therapy of all the other children. Why not help her?
Why didn't they?
Because they didn't take it seriously. Because the children, there were hundreds of children accusing 30 people. It started with Bob, but finally the children accused 30 people in town. If they were to take it seriously, everybody in town would have been in jail. Every child in town would have been in therapy, you know. I mean, they couldn't take it that seriously. Even they couldn't take it that seriously.
Didn't any parent stand up? I mean, parents care about the welfare of their kids, and clearly putting them through this is a horrendous thing if it's not true. You know, telling their kids that, encouraging them to say this if it isn't true. Did any parent balk and say, I'm not sure if this is true?
The only parents who balked and said it's not true are the parents who refused to send the kids to therapy or send them to independent therapies. There were a couple of mothers, one left town and sent her to a therapy out of town, and the therapist said there's nothing wrong with the child. Well, she was threatened by the prosecution. People who said they were not, that the children were not abused, were not liked in Edentown. And the people who sent the parents who sent their children to outside to independent therapies or did not send them to therapies balked and said no, it didn't happen. I mean, there was one child whose father was a vet, and the father said, look, I know when a puppy is sick. You know, so I know when my child is something happened to my child, and they refused to send the child to a therapist, and they said the child, nothing happened to her. I mean, she's happy, she is fine, she forgot Little Rascal, she's totally happy. As I say, the children who went to, you have to remember that most of the children denied there was abuse. When they started, they came with one allegation. Many children ended with 50 or 60 allegations. You know, I mean, it's
starting by saying nothing had happened.
Starting by saying nothing had happened. They denied it.
Of course, the prosecution would say that they were afraid something bad
of
would
course.
Happen to their parents. Or
sure, it's them if you do and them if you don't. If the child say no, it's because he's afraid. If he says yes, then of course it happened. You know, I mean, those cases are very, very difficult cases. And those cases are really, I think, should never go to the court. This is not where the truth will be found.
Well, Ofer Bekel, as we wrap up this interview, what are your thoughts after these three documentaries and now in just the last few days, the prosecutors saying that they're going to drop all pending charges except for an outstanding case against Bob Kelly?
Well, I have lots of thoughts. As far as the Little Rascal's case is concerned, I think nothing ever happened there. I think it was panic. I think it was parents who were afraid. I think it was fear and panic. As far as the system is concerned, I find it very scary because, you know, I always thought that when you didn't do that, if you're accused of something you didn't do, the system will take care of you. You don't have to be afraid. You didn't do it. You found out. The fact that you didn't do it is not relevant at all in the justice system. Not at all. Whether you, innocence is just not, doesn't come into it. You have, that I found very scary, that the system will not take care of you. Another thing that I learned is that when I hear that somebody pleaded guilty, that it doesn't really mean that they're guilty. So those are the three very quick lessons that I learned.
Ofer Bekel, I want to thank you very much for joining us, an award-winning frontline producer who, among other documentaries, has done a series of three documentaries on the Little Rascals Daycare Center in Edenton, North Carolina. The last one, Innocence Lost, The Plea, will air tonight on PBS stations around the country that air Frontline. You've been listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like an audio cassette of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our assistant producer is Errol Maitland. He's also our engineer. We also had assistance in production from Lauren Comito. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!